This morning, we're going to continue the sermon, or a brand new sermon series on the book of Esther. And one of the funny things about studying the book of Esther already has been that every time I talk to a pastor or a friend about Esther, they'll say, I've never preached that book before. And I say, well, I haven't either. That's why we're going to do it this year. And our goal, and we talked about this in the fall of last year, was we're going to try to end this series right around Purim, which is a Jewish celebration of the book of Esther, or the celebration of Purim, and we're going to talk about that as we get into this book, this in the series. And so we're going to spend about 7 weeks in Esther, 7 or 8 weeks, I think, and talking about the book of Esther. I want to give you a little bit of background on Esther as we get into the book, so just so you have some context. And how many of you have read the book of Esther before? How many of you have heard the name Esther before? Yeah, almost everyone, right? There's some Esther. And I think it's funny because sometimes I've been talking to people about the book of Esther, and then they'll start talking. I'm like, oh, that's Ruth. Because we kind of conflate these two books. How fantastic is it that in the Old Testament, there is two books that are have named after women, faithful women of God. And I don't think that's an Old Testament only thing, but I think that the fact that you got a book named after you is pretty incredible. Some other things that I want to kind of get off the jump here is, one of the things that Esther is famous for is it's the only book of the Bible that does not mention the name of God. Huh. Jim's excited. We talked about that. Yeah. Doesn't explicitly mention God at all, and yet makes it into the canon of Scripture, and we ought to wonder then why. What is going on in Esther that would be included in the canon of Scripture, even though God's name is not directly mentioned? And then the last thing I want to say to you before we get into the word today is this, that Esther was a Jewish orphan slave girl. And see, we often think about Esther being the queen, and Esther will be queen, we know that, but I want you to see that her story starts, and we'll hear this in the narrative, at the background, it's tucked up in there, that Esther was a Jewish orphan slave girl living under the rule of the Persian Empire. We're going to just talk about that a little bit this morning too. A little bit of history, not a lot, and then we will get into the meat and potatoes of the story of Esther. And so with that, I've asked Stephanie Kramer this morning to come and to read from the book of Esther. You can turn your Bibles. It is, if you have one of ours, it's on page 344, Esther 1:1 through 2:1.
All right, Esther chapter 1. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes, and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest, who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen, and purple material to silverines on the marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other. And the royal wine was abundant, in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way. For the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. On the 7th day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the 7 eunuchs who served him, Mahuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king. Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcena, and Memucan, the 7 nobles of Persia and Media who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. According to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti, he asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Then Memucan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the people of the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all women, and so all will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. The king and the nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province, in its own script and to each people in its own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be ruler over his own household. Later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephanie. So that's what we're going to talk about today, the beginning, the opening portion of the book of Esther. It's funny thinking about this. The first message today is titled, A Royal Mess. That's not right. It's a royal failure, a royal failure. And I was thinking about this, and I'm like, you know, what would this mean in modern day? Like, how would we look at this story of Xerxes and Vashti and then Esther? And it's going to get about Esther, but this opening prologue, you can hear that Esther hasn't been mentioned at all yet. This is a preamble of the book, of the story of the hero or heroine of our narrative. And so I was thinking about that, and I don't know, how many of you caught this, like, when Harry met Meghan stuff that's going on? Anybody watching that stuff? Harry, Prince Harry, none of you. You're good red-blooded Americans. You're like, why would I waste my time on the monarchy? We left them over tea taxes. Here, this is not my problem. Well, what's funny about it is I'm with you in that I'm not very interested, except that a lot of folks I know have continued to follow the drama of the royal family. That Harry has forsaken his role as a prince, and then Meghan has her stuff that she's upset. She's an American actress, and so we're getting blamed for her behavior. And, you know, it's this international dispute. You know that the queen is dead, right? So there's a new king. I mean, there is this royal intrigue happening in Europe, right? It really does matter. And then God forbid if I would talk about Prince Andrew and the scandals with Andrew. I mean, it's just awful. What is going on? And the funny thing that I want to keep in mind, because how many of you grew up like watching princess movies and stuff? A few dudes? Okay, good. And so it's like, some of that stuff, it's like, I want to be a queen in a castle. I want to be a princess in a castle. I'm going to be a king. I'm going to be a prince. And we kind of teach, Mike talked last week about the armor of God, and we're going to put on these breastplate, and we're going to have the sword, you know, we're going to do these things. But we act as if the people in the royal household aren't people like us. A mess in the family. And so we're going to kind of talk about this for this morning from that perspective of, yes, they're royalty, and yes, it's going to matter, but we're going to break it down and try to make it, you know, about like common, like how does it really work for us, and what can we learn from this, even this opening chapter of Esther. And so we're going to keep that in mind as we think about, and by the way, one last thing on this is, like, we have a tendency to think that all the people who are successful have it together, and that is clearly not true. We're going to hear that today in this narrative. So the beginning, Stephanie read for us, says, this is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. At the time, Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. I want to stop there. And the first question I have is, well, who is Xerxes, right? What do we know about Xerxes? And this is where you start a Bible study, right? You're like, you flip the Bible up, and you see a name you don't know, and you're like, who is this dude? Why is he in the Bible? What's it matter, right? And so I look up Xerxes, and immediately I trip over the name Xerxes. Because Xerxes sounds super cool, right? I mean, I think it sounds cool. It's got two X's in it. That's kind of legit. And it sounds powerful. And it sounds Greek, which is always a good thing. And it is. But interestingly, the Persian name would not be Xerxes, although Xerxes is how he's referred to in his time. And here, his real name, and I'm going to try to pronounce this, real name, forgive me. His name in Persian apparently was something close to Akashvarash. Akashvarash. Now, you don't have to know to say that, but when you click on Xerxes in the Hebrew, it takes you to a word that says nothing like, it's nothing close to Xerxes. And I was like, wait a minute. Why are the translators changing the name from Akashvarash to Xerxes? Well, first of all, because it's easier to say. That's probably why they're doing it. And secondly, because this idea of Esther and the story of Esther is attributed to the Persian Empire based on some historical dating. That is to say that when you read some of the context, they will say, well, there's no historical proof that Esther ever happened. Right? And we're talking about why that maybe is true from history's perspective, and yet why it may be true that all of these things happened. And even if it didn't, the narrative stands. This would be considered a historical attribution for the day of Purim. Why did Jews celebrate Purim? Because of what Esther did. What did Esther do? She became queen under King Xerxes I. Okay, so what more can we learn about King Xerxes from history? The first this is that his name that I just tried to say to you almost one more time, Akashvarash, listen, meant the king of all male. Huh? It meant the king, not the king of all men, the king of all male. Yeah, King Xerxes. I knew I liked this guy. I'm like, yes, the male king. And I know historically most kings were males. They were all males, right? Some queens were. But my point is that he was the king of all male. His name literally in Persian means the king of all male. He was a manly man. Did you hear that in the story today? We're going to talk about that. Okay, so then one final stop here on the name. Some Septuagint translations, that would be the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, actually call him Artemetes. And Artemetes means the son of Artaxerxes. I'm sorry. And Artaxerxes means the son of Xerxes. So the Arta means son of Xerxes. So then there's like some people say, wait, it wasn't King Xerxes, it was King Xerxes' son. We're going to just set that aside. If you want to talk about the history of it, I'd be glad to do so. We can dig into it. But it doesn't really affect the overall narrative that we're going to learn from. So when did King Xerxes rule? From 486 to 465 before Christ. 486 to 465 BC. Those numbers go backwards. That means that's his time of ruling. What else do we learn about King Xerxes? First of all, he's prone to women. He's the king of all male. He's prone to women. And secondly, he's prone to making extravagant offers. Now, when I say that about Xerxes, I'm not talking because of what we read in the Bible. I'm talking about the historical account of Xerxes from I think it's Homer and people like that. They tracked his life, and they said he was prone to women, and he was prone to extraordinary offers. So now you see some historical context, like this sounds a lot like Xerxes, you know what I mean? Prone to women, prone to extravagant offers. He was part of the Archimedial Empire, or easier said, the Persian Empire, right? So he was a ruler from them. And if you can believe it, if you look up King Xerxes I, we actually have a picture of him because he had an iPhone. He didn't have an iPhone. They carved his face in a wall, and that still exists. Right today, you could go to a museum, you could see this piece. It is actually a relief cut into a wall of King Xerxes sitting on his throne. Now, this is pretty helpful for us, right? Because a couple things I want to point out before we move forward into the word today is, first of all, you can see he is sitting on a throne. You see it? You guys are not impressed. Secondly, he has this long, pointy staff. You see that? Third, he has this thing in his hand. It's not a flower. It could be a flower, but it looks like it's a cup. I think it's a cup. I'm going to go with a cup. But that is just the beginning. I told you he's the king of all male. Here's the main thing about King Xerxes, remember. Look at this beard. Boom, baby. Yeah. I mean, this dude was keeping it tight. He must have been doing some shaping. Look how far down it is. Look at it. I don't even know. Wow, man. King Xerxes with his beard. That's legit. Nobody appreciates that but me. I appreciate that. Ryan, come on. I appreciate it. He's the male king. He is a ruler over his time, and he does have real authority. Okay, that's enough of that. Let's move on in the word and hear what's going on in King Xerxes' life. It says this, verse 2, and at the time King Xerxes reigned in his royal throne in the city of a citadel of Susa, and in the third year, now listen to the, we're going to have to catch some dates here, it's subtle, of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and all his officials and the military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were all present. So King Xerxes has all of his leadership together. You might go, well, why does he have all his leadership together? Well, let's read on. Verse 4, for 180 days, a full 100 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and the glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days. Now I want to go, what is going on that this dude has 180 days of an open kingdom? And here is what had happened. He had won in war. He had defeated an enemy. And after his defeat, he called together all of his people, his warriors and his accomplices, his officials, and he said, I'm going to open my whole kingdom up in my victory. And you all can walk around for 180 days and enjoy my splendor. What's the word say? My glory. And so I want to tell you this morning that victory can lead us to opening our hearts and our lives. A victory makes us gregarious, right? Makes us bigger than life. We won, right? Do you want to come in? Come on in. We just won. And for 180 days, his entire kingdom was open. Why is this a big deal? Because here's the thing. Before this, it would have been closed because people were trying to kill him. People were trying to kill his people. But the minute he wins, he throws the doors open. And he says, 180 days, everyone come, walk around and see the splendor and the glory that is King Xerxes. He's demonstrating, this is like old school MTV Cribs, right? But you don't have a TV, so you gotta walk through the place and see for yourself. What? I can't believe people live like this. I actually don't know how to make you feel as a peasant walking through the king's palaces, but I guess if you called him your king, you'd feel like you kind of own it too. You know, you don't get to use it or be there, but fair enough. And so he has this thing, 180 days, that's my math, 6 months. Is that about right? 6 months that he has his kingdom open to demonstrate, I want to say it again, his splendor and the glory of his majesty, his grandeur. Look at what I have accomplished. Not only have I beat these my enemies, but look at all I have retained in the process. Verse 5, when the days were over, the king gave a huge banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace. For all people, listen to the word, from the least to the greatest, who were in the citadel of Susa. And so for all the people who live there locally, he's like, come in, I'm having a banquet for 7 days. And you guys can come in and hang out and check out everything for yourselves. Look in verse 6, this is wild. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen. Those would be a pretty exclusive things to get, color blue, and keeping things white, I would imagine. The garden, and fastened with cords of white linen and purple. I know for a fact purple is hard to make. To silver rings hung on marble pillars. So you can imagine just glorious grandeur of the flowing linens hanging by silver rings. I mean, this must have been overwhelming. Marble pillars. Listen to this, man. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Now, I don't know what porphyry is. It sounds like potpourri, but I don't think it's what it is. I think it's porphyry. It's some kind of a stone. But I know what mother of pearl is. And I know what marble looks like. We all know what marble looks like. And so you can imagine now you're walking through and you're seeing these big things, and all of a sudden you're seeing couches where people can sit and recline and rest of gold and silver. And then I'm like, are they really gold and silver? Because if they were like real gold and silver, that would be kind of awful, wouldn't it? Like, I'm on a golden throne. I won't be here long because it's going to hurt. But they used to be able to pull golden thread and weave with it and make, and so like, you know, and they would put stuff on like the, what's it called, plating. They would plate things gold. And so it was a way to just exude wealth. And you're walking through a commoner, the least to the greatest get to go, and you get to recline on these couches and just go, man, in a sense that we've all made it. We've all arrived for 7 days. The floor is a mosaic of these precious stones. And then here we go, verse 7. And wine was being served in goblets of gold. These probably are solid goblets, right? Each one different from the other. And the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. Now, I'm just sad to say this. This was a party. And unless you think people are like going like, oh, yes, sir, yes, it's quite a nice day. Yes, yeah, oh, yes, yes, King Xerxes, yes, he's quite. No, it was like a frat house, I think. It was like, wow, the king said all the wine I can drink. And if you don't think that's true, when it says from the least to the greatest, that means people showed up that didn't belong there. They weren't part of polite society. And they're like, we're going to party, man. You know, you ever had your boss pick up a tab at a bar? It's dangerous, right? Because that dude owes you. If it's the king, dangerous, dangerous. To go on to that point a little more, even it says that the guests were allowed to consume as much. It says this in the NIV. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way. For the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man as he wished. But what that really means is they could have as much as they want. It was an open bar. That's what it means, okay? So just laying that down there for what it's worth. This was a big party, 7 days. It's getting rowdy. The king's like, keep the wine coming. Keep the wine coming, right? And by the way, unless you don't think these things still happen, this often will happen today at a wedding feast. Okay, I'm sorry, a wedding, a banquet. Okay, what's it called? Yeah, the after party after a wedding. The reception. I've known couples that have often said, you know, we're just going to do like 1 hour, and then that's it, and then everybody can behave and go home. But usually there's someone there that has a checkbook that says, you know what, let's open the bar. Often that happens. This is an old trait of humanity. It's time to celebrate as much as you want, as much as you want. And by the way, I do want to say that there was this idea that, look, each man consumed what he chose to consume. There was no requirement that he consume more. So we're going to go on here then in the story. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink what he wanted. Okay, verse 9. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. A couple things I want to say about this. First of all, that might mean that they separated the whole party by men and women. So you got a frat house party happening, and you got probably this distinguished, proper party. You know, they're having wine, but they're not being idiots, I would imagine, right? That's just me projecting into history, but, you know, if current days ain't like it, you know, you have the wild bunch and the, you know, wise people, let's say. But Queen Vashti gave a banquet separate for the women in the royal palace, King Xerxes. She's having her own party. Here we go, 10. On the seventh day of the party, King Xerxes was in high spirits from what? From wine. I told you it was a party. And he commanded his 7 eunuchs who served him, and thank you, Stephanie, for saying the names. It doesn't matter, but they have 7 names here. Verse 11, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, because she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. And the king became furious, and he burned with anger. Interesting now, okay? So 180 days of an open kingdom. He's like, I'm going to have a 7-day party. Everyone can come, least to the greatest. There's no limit to the wine and everything. And on day 7, the king is feeling it. He's feeling it, right? And in this moment, he calls his eunuchs. And by the way, if you know what a eunuch is, it was someone that was considered to be sexually safe with the queen. They were men who could attend to women with no concern. We won't get into the details of that, but that's what it was, right? So they weren't a threat to the king. He wouldn't send his warriors down there to do that because that would be trouble, but he'd send these safe men down to help care for the women and bring the requests back and forth in a proper way. And we know now that Queen Vashti, in her moment here, refuses to come. It said, I want to point out 2 things. It says, when the king, on the 7th day, King Xerxes was high in spirits with wine. Stop there. And then the last verse, and the king became furious and burned with anger. In the middle of that, things happened that he did not expect. But I can't help but stop here for a moment and say, as much as I was saying it's a frat house party, it's a good time or anything like that, you know, the Bible has things to teach us about drinking. And I know some people who are Christians today, they go like, I'm a teetotaler, I don't touch this stuff, I never did, you know, and that's awesome. Nothing wrong with that at all. But the Bible isn't explicitly prohibitive of drinking, but it is cautionary about drinking. And if nothing else, we could see in Xerxes a cautionary drinking tale, right? He's the king. He just won. He's had a six-month vacation, and now he's having a party, and he's going to make a total mess out of stuff here because of his anger. Proverbs 21, and by the way, that's great, remember it. Not 21, but 21, like we can drink at 21 here, it says this: wine is a mocker and beer is a brawler. Whoever is led astray by them is not wise. I just want to throw it in here because even King Xerxes and all of his authority and all of his power was weak when it came to following wine. Not to say he shouldn't have any, but the fact that it ruled him or it led him, and you can see in the Proverbs where it says, if you're led astray by it, you're not wise. That this is a temptation that continually pulls at us to pursue it down a rabbit hole. And King Xerxes pursues it right down the rabbit hole. Well, let's talk then about what happens when the queen's having her own party. She knows the king's having a big blowout. And when he sends these eunuchs to ask her to come before the group, it says that she refused the king, a king's order. She said, I'm not doing it. I know what's going to happen. By the way, can I just say something about King Xerxes' request here? I've been praying and prayed about it, and as I read it, the first time I read it through, and I keep praying, and like, I don't want to put things in, but it seems like an odd request. I mean, you heard about the golden couches and the silver couches and the big, long, you know, flowing fabric with the silver rings hanging off of the pillars and all the splendor of his majesty, his glory, but he also sees his bride, the queen, Queen Vashti, as part of that. And you have to think in some way, in this moment of imbibery, of wine, that he's like, I'm going to bring my queen out. And she's going to parade around in front of the people so they can be impressed with what? Her? Me. Right? You know, I call this like the dance monkey idea, right? Like, dance monkey. You know what I mean? You ever had that? You got a skill, someone appreciates you for it, and you get around a group, and all of a sudden somebody's like, hey, do that thing, do that thing, do that thing. It's like, I don't want to do the thing. No, do it, man. This is really great. Do it, do it, do it. That's kind of what that's like. Like the queen. And I can imagine, and I'm just imagining this is extra biblical, but I can just imagine because I've been married for 29 years, that whenever I text my wife, hey, you coming to this party? She's like, no. Idiot. I don't want to be part of that. I know what happens over there. I know those people. And instead of the king being like, I shouldn't have asked. Sorry, guys. She ain't coming. He gets angry with the queen. It says he burns in this moment. You know what's funny? Biblically, we have a great verse on this. This is Ephesians 5:21, and the word says, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And I just want to put that in there because we have these same failings and tendencies that both King Xerxes and Queen Vashti have. And I'm not saying, don't hear me say that this morning, that the queen should have come out there and done it. It's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that both of them should have been submitted unto one another in such a way that they would not be doing something that the other didn't want to have happen. So when someone's like, hey, have your queen come out here and walk around, I'd be like, no, dude, she ain't doing it. I ain't doing that to her. She's having her own party over there. Or whenever you do say, hey, will you come? Be like, I don't want to come over there. In some way, submitting to one another. I was doing a wedding for a couple. And we met for premarital counseling, and we were sitting in the office, and I was like, so what do you think about your wedding? What are your plans? The only time I do it is the first session, and I'm like, just tell me what you'd like to have happen and, you know, in the ceremony. Let's talk about the ceremony for a minute. And the first thing the bride said to me is, I don't want any submission talk at my wedding. I went, oh boy, we got 5 weeks of counseling. Not because the Bible says women submit to your husbands, although that's implied from verse 5:21, but it says submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Submit to one another. Women to your husbands. But there's no submit there. It's implied from the previous. And then husbands, love your wives. It's implied there. The submission is an act of love, that you're going to not rule over her. This is a biblical principle, that we ought not rule over one another in a harsh way. And that's what's happening. There's tons of failure happening and not a lot of submission by Xerxes or Queen Vashti. So now we have this refusal and the king is angry, angry with this. Let's see what the word says. 15, since it was customary for the king to consult experts in the matter of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men that understood the times and were closest to the king. So he asked his friends, and I'm not going to name these names again. Steph did a great job of reading them. The last one's the important one, Memucan, the seven nobles of Persia and Media, who had special access to the king and were the highest in the kingdom. So now he pulls together his closest people. He says, what should be done? Look at 15. According to the law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? I just want to stop here and say this. Anger leads to excuses. That's what I want to say. Anger leads to excuses. You see, he's feeling, you know, the effects of the wine. He's high on wine, basically. And then he gets bitterly angry when his bride, the queen, refuses to come down, right? And then he asks this question. Isn't it funny? According to the law. See, he doesn't want to take responsibility in saying, I'm upset with the queen. I can do what I want. I'm the king. He calls together his friends. He gets a group of people who are going to kind of agree with him anyway. And he's like, hey, y'all, what should I do according to law? I want to do this right. What should I do according to law? And his anger leads to excuses in the way that he starts to try to move the responsibility for how he's feeling outside of himself. Oh, I have to do something. I can't do nothing. And my hand is forced here. Can I just tell you something? We're going to find out in a minute. He could have done anything he wanted because he's the king. He could have let it go. He could have pardoned her. She could have came and touched the little stick thing that he has to have touched, and that means it's okay. I mean, there's 1,000 things he could have done. But he turns to a group of people. Well, what do I have to do? You know, I said to folks before, one of the problems that whenever you're trying to be in a long-term relationship with someone is there's a tendency to take it to an outside group who's going to have your back. You know? Have you ever sat around a bar with a guy who's had a bad breakup? And who's around him giving him advice? A bunch of dudes who are at a bar who've probably had a bad breakup. Yeah, man, to heck with that woman. And even that might be the way, worst thing, advice he could hear right then, right? Just divorce her, man. How can you put up with that kind of stuff? And I know you're a woman and you're like, well, you know, that's women, whatever. But what about those coffees, you know? Let's get a coffee. Did you hear? Susie? Oh, no, Susie. Oh, my gosh. How do you put up with a man like that? Oh, I could never, right? What do I have to do? Well, I read in a magazine, and you know what it says? You take the survey. You know what it says? All I'm saying, and I'm not picking on men or women here, we all have this brokenness. We're gonna instead of trying to reconcile or take responsibility, we're gonna go to someone who's gonna agree with us. Well, what does the law have to do? The king asks. And we're gonna explicitly see that the king could have done anything he wanted to do in that moment. What does the law require of her? Our anger leads to our excuses. Then Memucan, the seventh noble, replies in the presence of the king and all his nobles. So this is a thing. Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against the nobles and the peoples of the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all women, and so they will all despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. And this very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. This is subtle what's happening here, but I think it's really interesting, right? So he asked the question, what should be done? And this gentleman, Memucan steps up with a thought, and his thought is first, the minute that this gets out, he takes the problem that the king and the queen are having, and he just globalizes it. The minute that the women in all the provinces, 127 provinces, and all the nations and all the languages hear the queen refuse the king and can do that, they're all going to refuse their husbands. This is a slippery slope argument. This one failure is going to lead to failure everywhere, man. And not only that, but then he dials it back a bit. He says, and the Persian and Median wives who are here, who already saw it, are going to refuse their own husbands here. Some of those dudes are in the room. I'm going to go home, and my wife's going to say, well, if Queen Vashti, you don't have to listen to King Xerxes. I don't have to listen to you. Who do you think you are? As if they're not all in their own relationships. There's a fallacy here, right? And I had a slide, didn't make it in, I don't know how I lost it, it got lost, but it said something like this. Ego and slippery slope arguments lead to dangerous situations. When you go, this one little thing happened, and you're like, well, if that happened, then all these things could happen. We get ourselves into a whole big mess of problems. Instead of saying, first of all, I'm hurt. Queen Vashti, I wish you to come. And she could have been like, you know what? You shouldn't call me when you're drunk for your friends. And he'd be like, you're right. And I'd be like, and then she'd be like, you're right. And they all get on the carriage and go happily ever after into the kingdom. That's my theory. That's my theory. Now, I'm not saying it works like that. And you go, well, Bill, historically, these kings and queens, you don't understand. You're right. You're right. But they were people like us, having the same failings that we have. And you don't have to be a king and a queen to have a big blowout publicly. Can I insert one more thing here? Social media is a dangerous thing for egos and slippery slope arguments and rah-rah parties that lead to our failure. It's just not an honest place to have a conversation, especially about things that are important to you. How can I live like this with someone like that? Girl, I'll tell you what I would do. Listen, it's dangerous. You must know it's public. And I'm not mad about it, but we should be wise. We should be wise in how we interact. So we have this idea then, if you can check our ego and we cannot make these grandiose, you know what? Oh, now that this thing happened, there's all these failures going to come. Not necessarily. It's just the failure. That one time I was drunk, I asked you to come, you refused. We can get over this. That could have happened too. But it's dangerous when it drags us down. So then we're going to go on here into the decision being made, right? Queen's kind of known to this big group and the small group, and there will be no end. And there's this big dramatic flourish. There will be no end of the disrespect and discord. In other words, we fought hard for this, and we're not going to give it away, even if it's to our wives. 19, therefore, he listens to the word. If it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree. You know what that is? A law. And let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which can never be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. I just want to stop there for a moment. This is the first time in the book of Esther that Vashti is mentioned, not as Queen Vashti. See, for this gentleman, Memucan, she is already dethroned. At the king's word, she's no longer Queen Vashti. She's just Vashti. She loses everything. And that's interesting to me that here he does not attribute. It's the only place. After this mention of Vashti, she's mentioned twice more, but only as the deposed queen in the whole book. 11 times, 9 in the first chapter. Her story is over in the kingdom. We're going to talk about that in a moment. So Vashti will never again enter the presence of King Xerxes. And also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Really? When the king's edict is proclaimed throughout his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands, and from the least to the greatest. There's the same language, right? One last verse, and we'll stop and talk about it. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice. And so the king did as Memucan promised, or proposed, I apologize. Stopping there. This is another thing. I said anger leads to excuses. Here's another thing, though. Be careful when you start seeking legal advice for personal relationships. Just want to walk this out for a minute. So the king said, what must be done according to the law? And you have conversation. I was just talking to a friend of mine who's struggling with some legal issues, and they're like, man, I hate to do this, but I feel like I have to do it, right? And it wasn't about personal stuff there, but it felt personal. In our own country, whenever we dissolve a marriage, it's a legal entanglement, the marriage is. It has to be legally unentangled. There's something called divorce. And someone goes, I'm just going to check with a lawyer and see what my options are. You got to be careful doing those things. I would even say this. You work for someone. And you're like, this place is terrible. This boss is terrible. And you're like, I might contact a lawyer. Because what is happening there is you're trying to find an outside authority to give you permission to do what you want to do anyway, or a place for your grievance that you already have anyway. You just need someone else to be your advocate in a court to prove you right or give you something you want. Why would I say that? To be careful when you start seeking legal advice, because these are personal relationships. And I would say this, the moment you start to pursue legal options, you're probably done. You're probably done. Oh, we're going to reconcile afterwards? We're going to get along after the lawsuit better? Probably not. In the New Testament, it says, if you and a brother or sister have a legal dispute between you, settle it on the way to the court. Don't let it get to court. That's a biblical principle for Christians. Figure it out. I know nothing's reconcilable. I'm not saying that. I'm not blaming anyone who's gone through anything legal with anyone else. That's not what I'm saying. But I mean, this king is in trouble already, and the queen too, when they start asking legal questions of their personal relationship. So then it pleases everyone. This is another dangerous thing. It pleases everyone. We're going to wrap here. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, that's writing, and to each people in their own language. This dude ruled a lot of territory. They didn't even speak the same language as him. Proclaiming in each person's tongue that every man should be ruler over his household. And let's just say again, and this is something we talk about in church all the time, that there's an idea of headship in a household, but it's never domineering. It's never domineering. It's never ruling over people or oppressing them. It's not what it was intended to be. That's actually a sinful brokenness of a model that God has established for us. Chapter 2, verse 1. Later, listen to this, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. And I want to throw that in there because I read that verse, and I don't know how you read that verse, but I don't read that verse like, he remembered. And he was like, yes. I think he was like, oh man, what did I do? I've lost my queen. You see, because in the end of the day, you can be right about everything and wrong. You could argue your points every point along the way, and everyone says, yes, you're right, you're right, you're right, but you get the result you don't want. And I can't read this and think that Xerxes wanted her gone forever. Why would he call her to a party? She was his queen. She was unique. And we're going to find out as we read through Esther that this creates a spiral in his life. It creates a real practical spiral for this king that lasts years after this moment. So it says he remembered Vashti. Notice, not queen. And what she had done and what he had proclaimed. Now what? He can't go back. He can't go back on his word. How would his subjects view him? Two things I want to close with. Not in the text, just from the text. The first is, no matter how you read the first chapter of Esther, one of the ways I read it is like this. A queen who missed her calling. A queen who missed her calling. That's not blaming her, saying she should have come or anything else. But I wonder if she had known at this one day for this one party to walk out with these people for a moment and let them see her, it would cost her her kingdom. That her refusal to go would cost her this great paradise that she had had for how many years she'd had it, right? She was the queen, and she lost it. A queen who missed their calling. Why would I say that to you today? Because God is not mentioned in the book of Esther. And yet, I can't help but read this and see the king and queen and God and this ruling authority. I can't help but see us walking around on marble floors with mother of pearl on gold couches and silver couches, enjoying the splendor of the king after a victory, from the least to the greatest, that we get to be there. And I can't help but imagine being a bride or a queen who's invited to come to the king and says, I'm not coming. Kingdom's open, it's beautiful, I'm not coming. Many times in our own lives, we refuse to respond to God's call. But I want to quickly add this, that as much as there's a failure of a queen to respond to her calling, there's a failure of a king to be loving and good. And we can see that in the text as well. But here's the truth, that you and I don't serve a king like Xerxes. We serve a benevolent king with a much more glorious kingdom and many more languages of peoples. And we're invited into it as his queen. And I will say this, that if God were to call you, and we talked this morning about if God's calling you to serve in leadership, or he's calling you to serve the church in some way, or he's calling you to serve in the community in some way, or calling to serve a coworker, or your husband, or your wife, or your children, or your parents in some way, that when he's calling us into these places that require faith and to wear our crown, you know, that's what he said. He said, put your crown on and come to me, right? Come to me as part of the royalty. I want to show you off. That he's not doing that to make fun of us. I said, how do I read Xerxes in here? Maybe he's, you know, he's a little suspect way. He's asking his queen to come. But when God calls you and I to respond to him, he's not calling us as one that he's going to make fun of or objectify. He's saying, these are my people. They're glorious. They're my glory. And that's the invitation that we have to participate with him. He's a benevolent king who would never do anything to harm us. And indeed, like Xerxes, we stand in the season of victory, not defeat, of the kingdom being open, and we can come in, and we can trust him, and we can participate. He is good. And so with that, I want to just remind you that wherever you are, whatever's going on, and whatever struggles, and if you didn't recognize, and I recognize a bunch in my own life in this text, those things aren't exclusionary to the kingdom. It means you can't come if you don't have a perfect marriage. You can't come if you don't have a perfect life. It means that God's doors are open wide, and he's like, you come to me. I love you, and I will make you the kingdom person that I designed you to be. It's the invitation. Pray with me if you would. Father God, for your kingdom and your glory and your people, we give you thanks and praise. We bring our words first to you because you are worthy of our praise. And then, Father, as we see the brokenness of our earthly kingdoms, we know that your kingdom coming is more than we could hope for or imagine. I pray today, Father, that those who are here with us and they're struggling with whatever's in their life, that they know that your kingdom has peace and rest and hope and eternity. I pray, Father, that all of us, as we continue to see your doors open and stroll around, that we just appreciate the invitation to be with you forever, and that we would not, Father, I pray, we would not be the people that would close the doors behind us and let the rest of the world suffer, but we would say, this kingdom is open to you. You can join us here, sinners though we are, with King Jesus. Would you help us to do that work today, Father? Help us to be open-hearted toward those who are outside the walls. Help us to be invitational to those who don't think they belong. And then, Father, for all the work that you're going to do as only you can, and the things we're learning in the book of Esther as we go forward in Esther's faithfulness to you and her obedience to a call, that we would be re-encouraged again to be faithful to the things you've called us to. Lord, help us to cling to you in our times of need. And to know that you are holding on to us, as we sang earlier. May you be glorified. We love you so much. We thank you for your word and the opportunity we have to learn together from you. In Jesus' name, amen.